Yesterday, December 7, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
It's a date every American learns, the attack on Pearl Harbor. 2 months later, President Franklin Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, which authorized the relocation of Japanese and Japanese Americans in the United States.
When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, our West Coast became a potential combat zone. Living in that zone were more than 100,000 persons of Japanese ancestry, two-thirds of them American citizens, one-third aliens. We knew that some among them were potentially dangerous. But no one knew what would happen among this concentrated population if Japanese forces should try to invade our shores. Military authorities therefore determined that all of them, citizens and aliens alike, would have to move.
The War Relocation Authority, a federal agency, produced films to defend the new policy of internment.
Neither the Army nor the War Relocation Authority relished the idea of taking men, women, and children from their homes, their shops, and their farms. So the military and civilian agencies alike determined to do the job as a democracy should, with real consideration for the people involved.
But many Japanese Americans refused to leave, risking arrest. Fred Korematsu, a resident of Oakland, California, was one of them. Fred passed away in 2005, but in a series of interviews before his death, he explained why he chose to defy the order.
I felt that it was wrong because to be pushed into this evacuation and also threatened with punishment because you look like the enemy. They don't say you're an American citizen because they've taken the American citizen away from you, which is wrong.
Korematsu was eventually picked up by the police in San Francisco and charged with violating the president's executive order. His family was moved to the Central Utah War Relocation Center in Topaz, Utah. But with the help of the ACLU, Korematsu sued the government, taking his case all the way to the Supreme Court.
I felt that I was an American citizen, and I had just as much right as anyone else. And being accused as the enemy, which I have no part of it, I don't even had any ties with Japan, nor have I ever been there. And to be accused like this, well, I just thought it wasn't fair. It was wrong.
In 1944, the court reached the 6-3 decision against Korematsu, finding that Executive Order 9066 was constitutional in the name of national security. And it's that case, Korematsu versus the United States, that Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor cited in her dissent on Tuesday in Trump versus Hawaii, the 5-4 decision that upheld the president's ban on travel mostly from Muslim nations. Chief Justice John Roberts argued that Korematsu had, quote, nothing to do with this case, but took the step to announce that the Supreme Court was overruling the 1944 decision. So where does that leave the nation on the question of discrimination and national security? This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. And today we're looking back at Korematsu versus United States to better understand the court's decision to uphold a president's travel ban this week. Noah Feldman is a professor of law at Harvard University, and he's a columnist at Bloomberg Opinion. We spoke to him before Justice Anthony Kennedy announced his retirement.
It's generally considered one of the worst Supreme Court opinions in the modern history of the court, because essentially in that case, the court deferred to the president's national security justification for interning Japanese Americans, when in reality, there was really no need to do so. And so the result is that the modern court generally only mentions Korematsu as an example of what not to do. It's a sort of model of bad Supreme Court decision making.
So when we look at yesterday's ruling, I think what stood out to us, and I think to a lot of folks, was how Justice Sonia Sotomayor did invoke the Korematsu case. Tell us a little bit about her strategy in doing that.
Well, Justice Sotomayor was trying to make the point that this is not just your ordinary bad decision by the conservative majority of the court. Rather, this is the kind of bad decision that will rank with some of the worst decisions ever made by the court. And in particular, what she said was that in the Korematsu case, the Supreme Court listened to President Roosevelt's fake national security justification. And here she said a reasonable observer would take one look at the so-called a Muslim travel ban and say, look, this is based on animus. This is based on bias and discrimination. So that is the message that she was trying to send to the majority, and the majority was listening. That's very clear from Chief Justice John Roberts' response.
And tell us a little about Chief Justice Roberts' response to this specific raising of Korematsu.
Well, being accused of authoring an opinion that's on the same standard of badness as Korematsu is serious business. And so Chief Justice Roberts first denied that his decision was anything like Korematsu. And then he said that for good measure, he was going to take the opportunity to say something the court had never explicitly said before, namely that Korematsu was a bad decision, that it was wrong the day it was decided, and that it had been, he said, quote, overruled by the court of history, close quote. So he was really essentially trying to change the subject by saying, let's tell the world that we've actually said that Korematsu is wrong in the hopes of deflecting attention from the fact that Justice Sotomayor was comparing his decision itself to Korematsu.
But saying that the court of history overruled it is one thing, but actually overruling a decision, is that even possible?
Well, it is in theory possible to overrule a decision, but only if the same issues come before the court again. So what the Chief Justice could do is sort of make a declaration, what lawyers call dicta, words that say, we don't like this, we won't follow it, but they don't actually obligate the court not to follow it in the future. So this is a symbolic statement, and it's a statement that future litigants would be unwise if they were to quote Korematsu. But it can't literally be an overruling because the issues in this case were different from the issues in the Korematsu case.
So let's talk a little bit about that, because the role of quote-unquote national security is something that's playing both in this decision and in Korematsu. Can you give us the distinction between how it's played out in both of these decisions?
Sure. I think from an ordinary viewer's perspective, it's actually really similar in that in both instances, the government did something, the executive branch, in fact, and said, we have a national security reason for doing this, and the court let them get away with it. So in that sense, they're similar, and that's what Justice Sotomayor was saying. The technical difference between the two circumstances is that in the Korematsu case, the government said that it was detaining people based on the threat to national security, not based on their race. And the court accepted that and said, yes, that's true. And therefore, there was no violation of the equal protection of the Constitution. What was at issue here was the subtly different question of whether the court should even consider the argument that President Trump's ban was based on religious animus. And what the court said is that in a circumstance where the president is acting within his core national security power, as long as the rule is on its face, not based on discrimination, it won't look to the possibility of discrimination. So that's very subtly technically different from the Korematsu situation.
Subtly, but it's obviously, it's had a huge impact, or it will have a huge impact. What is the sort of bar for determining religious animus on its face versus real religious animus? I feel like often in legal circles, it's hard to prove intent. Is that what we're talking about here? The intent of the president versus what is actually being debated?
Well, that is a big part of it. The question is, what will you look at to prove intent? And what I believe and what Justice Sotomayor was saying is that you should look at all of the circumstances, including how plausible is the president's justification and who does the order apply to. What the court said, though, was that it would not look to those circumstances as long as written, there was no explicit form of discrimination. In Korematsu, if you ask Chief Justice Roberts, he would say, well, the law mentioned Japanese Americans. Whereas here, the law doesn't say Muslims. It just lists people from seven countries, five of whom, the ones that are mainly directed at, are Muslim countries.
Does Justice Sotomayor's dissent pave the way for this case to be disregarded by future courts?
Justice Sotomayor is sending a message to future courts through the pages of the Supreme Court report saying, this is a bad one, and someday the court should repudiate this judgment the same way that the court is now repudiating Korematsu, a decision from several generations ago. So that's what her dissent is intended to do. It's intended to say, we were here, we know this was about bias, and history, don't pretend that we didn't know. And in fact, someone played a very similar role in the Korematsu decision. That was Justice Frank Murphy. Similarly said, this is about discrimination on the basis of race against Japanese Americans, and we should not forget that. And today, his dissent is remembered long after the majority opinions are treated as wrong.
And so is there any possibility of having this relitigated? Where does it go from here?
Well, there's a tiny, tiny sliver of a possibility. Justice Kennedy wrote a separate concurrence in which, in very contorted language, he said that it would be up to the lower court to figure out if even with all of the deference to the executive that the Supreme Court has called for, there was still enough evidence of anti-religious bias to justify going forward. So in theory, if there were lots of new evidence that could be introduced at trial of bias on the part of the president, that could potentially be used to bring the case back up through the courts. The problem is that we already know, and it's already public, what the president's motivations were here because he said them. And
well, that's what I was going to ask you. Are tweets admissible?
Yes, in principle, tweets are admissible, but here they've already been, as it were, disclosed to the court, and the Supreme Court said that those were not enough in light of the fact that the government had also offered a what they called a plausible justification separate from the possibility of bias. So essentially the court said, well, maybe there's bias here, but we're not going to even look at that question in a serious way because there's another possible non-biased reason that has been offered. I think a crucial thing to keep in mind about this opinion is not to allow the formalism of the court's writing and its insistence that, well, we have a rule of law here that suggests that we don't have to listen to obscure the reality, which is that everybody, including all of the justices of the Supreme Court, knows that this travel ban grew out of the first two rounds of travel bans, which were themselves explicitly justified by the president's claim on the campaign trail that he was going to keep Muslims out of the country. We all know this, and the part of you that is saying this can't be right is correct.
And I'm wondering what this tells us, if you could give us a sense of what does this tell us about the court overall under the Trump administration? Are we going to expect many more decisions like this, which are clearly divided on political and partisan lines?
The answer is yes. This has been one of the more expressly partisan with conservative outcomes terms of the court in recent memory. Often Justice Anthony Kennedy has been a swing voter in the past. This year, not so much. This year, he's overwhelmingly, almost without exception, joined the conservatives. Now, if Justice Kennedy resigns after this term, as some have speculated that he will, then the big question is whether President Trump will be able to nominate and confirm a successor before the midterm elections. If he is, we will have a firmly conservative Supreme Court for at least another generation.
Noah Feldman is a professor of law at Harvard University and a columnist at Bloomberg. Professor Feldman, thanks for joining us.
It was my great pleasure.
Just as a reminder, we spoke with Professor Feldman before Justice Kennedy announced his retirement. And now we'll be watching to see his predictions play out. And we'll be covering the story in depth tomorrow. And we wanted to add a special thanks to the Den Show Archives for providing us with access to the audio of Fred Korematsu. That interview was from 1983.
Ms. Amaya Lopez, anything you wish to say before sentencing?
No.
Dozens of immigrants are standing before a judge in Brownsville, Texas.
Mr. Garcia, Dean, anything you wish to say before sentencing?
No.
Mr. Rosario Vasquez, anything you wish to say before sentencing?
No.
And Mr. Castillo Toba, anything you wish to say before sentencing?
No.
Men and women lined up, one after the other, shackled in a courtroom and sentenced within minutes for illegally crossing the border.
Ladies and gentlemen, each one of you are sentenced to time served, $10 special assessment, and no fine. Don't come back illegally, because next time you probably will go to jail.
That audio is courtesy of our friends at The Intercept, and it's from inside a criminal court in Brownsville, Texas, back in May. Tuesday, here on The Takeaway, we heard about the impact of the Trump administration's policies on U.S. immigration courts. But today, we turn to what zero tolerance has meant for criminal courts, just like the one you heard, with a peek inside the world of a federal defense attorney who's on the front lines.
Most of the clients that we have seen in recent weeks are charged with illegal entry, a violation of 8 U.S.C. Section 1325. It is a petty offense, a misdemeanor crime that carries a maximum of 6 months in custody.
Elizabeth Barrows is supervisory attorney for the Federal Defenders of San Diego. It's a nonprofit that defends people facing federal drug and immigration charges.
They're being criminally prosecuted. Young men who have never been to our country before, who upon arrest promptly told the authorities that they were seeking asylum or feared return to their countries. My job is to defend them against the criminal charges that they're facing for illegal entry. And then once their criminal case ends, they will be transferred to immigration custody where their asylum case would proceed.
Since April, when the Trump administration announced its zero-tolerance policy to criminally prosecute all people who enter the United States illegally, the system has been flooded with new criminal cases. And Barros says the cases she's seeing now are not what she's used to.
The picture has changed dramatically. Most of my clients now have no criminal history. Many of them have never set foot in the United States before. Many of them have never been deported before. This is their first encounter with the United States and our justice system.
Now, she and her colleagues are trying to keep up with the deluge.
Yesterday in court, our attorneys handled about 90 new arraignments, and we were appointed to about half of those cases. So a typical week, an individual attorney may in the entire week be assigned 5 or 7 cases. Last week, for example, our attorneys picked up about 15 cases each. I can tell you last Monday, for example, I picked up 12 cases in one day, and I don't think it's sustainable.
Each court has its own methods. While some are trying and sentencing large groups of immigrants, as we heard earlier.
Ladies and gentlemen, each one of you are sentenced to time served, $10 special assessment, and no fine.
That is going on in places like Texas. In the Southern District of California, we don't have mass trials like that. The cases are called sometimes in group for the preliminary hearings, but we haven't had mass guilty pleas like that. What we are seeing are, since the Supreme Court reversed the Ninth Circuit's decision in Sanchez-Gomez, some of the magistrate judges in our district have started shackling defendants again and bringing them into court in restraints.
And once in the courtroom, Barros says many parents who'd been separated from their children, particularly up until last week, had one question.
Mr. Hernandez Lopez, anything you wish to say before sentence?
Si mi niña se va a ir conmigo cuando me deporten a mí.
Is my little girl going to go with me when I get deported?
She asks, is my little girl going to go with me when I get deported?
Our office has handled, I think, at least 9 of these cases where we've had parents that have been separated from their children. And it's not entirely clear to us how the reunification process is working or if it's working. In one of the cases, the child was returned to DIF in Mexico, which are the child protective services there, and there was no family there to receive the child that was held there.
In addition to issues of family separation, each of Barros' clients has a different background and set of obstacles that she has to take into account as she approaches their defense. They come from different countries and speak a variety of languages.
Our clients are women fleeing gender-related violence in Guatemala, young men fleeing gang-related violence in El Salvador, Southeast Asian clients seeking political asylum, Mexican clients fleeing poverty and cartel violence. And many of our Mexican clients are indigenous and cannot communicate fluently in Spanish. They are Mixteco speakers, Nahuatl speakers, Triqui speakers, to name just a few of the languages we encounter. I have 2 clients right now. They are young men who fled India, Punjabi speakers. And when they were first arrested for the first few days, they hardly ate anything because those young men were vegetarians and they were unable to communicate that. There's no one that speaks their language. And they didn't and still find it very difficult to navigate through the jail system, the jail policies. And they were unable to even communicate their dietary needs to jail staff. And so it took days for that information to be presented to the jail so that that could be addressed.
For now, though, Elizabeth Barros sees no end in sight to the need for many criminal defense attorneys working near the border.
People will continue to come to our country because they're fleeing worse situations in their home countries and violence and persecution there. And so as long as the administration continues to prosecute asylum seekers and prosecute people who are coming here for humanitarian reasons, I don't see our caseload going down.
Elizabeth Barros is one of the federal defense attorneys representing immigrants charged for crossing illegally into this country. She's also supervisory attorney for the Federal Defenders of San Diego. And if you want to listen back to our coverage on what it's like inside immigration courts, visit thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. If you like what you're hearing, give us a rating and review us on iTunes. It helps us in ways you can't imagine. Also, tell your friends. Share this podcast on Facebook or Twitter or wherever you want your followers to get some solid news coverage. They'll be smarter and they'll think you're a hero. It's a win-win.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and primary season continued chugging along on Tuesday. Voters went to the polls in New York, Colorado, Maryland, Utah, and Oklahoma to pick their midterm candidates. More on Oklahoma in just a few minutes. But here to break down the other key races is Dylan Scott, politics reporter for Vox. Hi, Dylan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the big news today is so far is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She beat Joe Crowley. Tell us a little bit about that, why this is such a significant upset.
Sure. So Joe Crowley has represented the Bronx and Queens in the House for 10 terms at this point. He's a member of House Democratic leadership, and there have been a lot of rumors in Washington that if Nancy Pelosi were ever to step aside, he could be one of the leading contenders to become the next Democratic leader or Speaker of the House. And so it was obviously shocking to have somebody in that kind of position lose. In a lot of ways, this primary race represented a lot of the divisions that we see within the Democratic primary right now. Ocasio-Cortez had kind of portrayed Crowley as a corporate-funded Democrat who had lost touch with his district. She, on the other hand, had endorsed Medicare for all and a federal jobs guarantee and free college for everybody. And so we've had a lot of those races across the country this primary season, but in many of those instances, it was two first-time candidates running to run against a Republican incumbent. And so I think the real shock here was that you had a very high-profile prominent Democrat who seemed to fall to the same kind of progressive wave that we're seeing a lot of in these races across the country.
And let's shift a minute to Maryland. Ben Jealous was a big win for Democrats there. What do you see? How do you see that race playing out?
Very similar, at least within the Democratic Party, that's a very similar story. Ben Jealous was a Bernie Sanders supporter. He had the support of a lot of those progressive groups, whereas the other prominent Democrat in that race, Rashawn Baker, was more of sort of the establishment choice. And so yet again, we saw the more left-wing candidate emerging from the Democratic primary. Looking ahead to the fall, Maryland currently has a Republican governor, Larry Hogan, who's relatively moderate. He's a cancer survivor and seems to enjoy some pretty broad popularity. And so that race, I think, will be a tension between, you know, we expect a very sort of anti-Republican, anti-Trump national environment, but whether, you know, Democrats can use that to push through a pretty progressive candidate against a more moderate and relatively popular Republican will be a test, because on its face, you know, Maryland as a pretty blue state seems like an obvious chance for Democrats to retake a governor's mansion. But between Hogan's popularity and Jealous's more progressive platform, I think that'll be one of the more fascinating governor's races to watch in the fall.
And of course, we had a very familiar face, Mitt Romney, who won in Utah. If Romney does win the general election, what's your sense of how he might be able, what his relationship with Trump could potentially be? He seems to be playing both sides occasionally, no?
Absolutely. I think there's a lot of never Trump Republicans who, you know, we're losing Jeff Flake and Bob Corker, two Senate Republicans who have been more critical of Trump, are leaving the Senate. I think they've imbued a lot of hope in Romney that he might be the new GOP critic of the president. But as you said, you know, on issues like immigration and taxes and Trump's kind of deregulatory agenda, Romney has been pretty positive towards the president. So I don't think we should expect him to come into the Senate and suddenly try to, you know, make a mess of things. He seems more likely to try to toe a delicate line when it comes to Trump.
Dylan Scott is a politics reporter for Vox. Dylan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we turn now to Oklahoma, which also had a primary on Tuesday. And though much of the focus was on the fight for the governorship, 10 Republicans were running for that seat. But down ballot, there were a host of new names for voters to choose from, many of them with a common background. Nearly 100 public school teachers and administrators threw their hats into the ring, primarily for state legislative races. And guess what? Nearly half of them ended up winning. Emily Wendler is an education reporter for State Impact Oklahoma, and she's been following the story. Emily, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So exciting times in Oklahoma. And before we get into the results, I'm just hoping you could tell our listeners a little bit about the circumstances surrounding the teachers' strikes in April. What were they fighting for?
Teachers were mad. It was a culmination of about 10 years of frustration over a lack of education funding. The threat of a strike prompted lawmakers to give teachers a pay raise. But teachers said that wasn't enough. They wanted more money for the classroom. And that's what the focus of the strike was getting more money for kids to lower class sizes, to hire back some teachers that had been let go over the years due to budget cuts.
And did they get what they were seeking?
They did not. And I think that's what fueled many of them to run for office. They felt like they were just rejected. I mean, they did get a teacher pay raise, but they walked out for 9 days and really got nothing additional financially by walking out for 9 days. And so they were like, well, if I'm going to make a change, I'm going to run for office.
What was the political split among the teachers who were running? Were they mostly Democrats? Were they mostly Republican? Did they have a cohesive sort of similar views on where they wanted to take things?
You know, that's kind of an interesting thing. Oklahoma's a really red state, but about 60% of the teachers that ran for office did run as Democrats. And then I'd say about 40% were running as Republicans. A few ran as independents. And, you know, even though teachers have this kind of this apple to stand on, like, hey, I'm a teacher, they're still a Democrat. And that's a tough race to run here in Oklahoma because it's a really conservative place.
So give us a sense of the outcomes. How did most of the teachers do?
I counted about 20 of them winning outright, about 20 of them going to a runoff. So I'd say about 40% of them will advance to the next stage of the election process. Some of those runoffs are going to be really tough races. So we will see. It's not over.
And we know that about 24 lawmakers in the state and the House voted against a bill that gave teachers a $6,000 average pay raise by hiking taxes on cigarettes, gas drilling, and internet sales. Was this politically motivated, or was it about putting pressure on lawmakers who voted against them than it was about actually winning seats and having a say in that way?
Sure. I mean, I went to a watch party last night for a teacher, and she said, you know, I just wanted to start a conversation. And that's why I ran, is to start a conversation, is to knock on doors and to talk to people, Republicans, Democrats, people from across the aisle, and help them see the plight of the average school teacher, and to kind of put some fear into some incumbents to say, like, look, we're serious, we're angry. And education was such a big deal during this primary election. Like, everybody was touting themselves as a pro-education candidate because that's what people are worried about right now.
Emily Wendler is the education reporter for State Impact Oklahoma. Emily, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
If you can't dance with your neighbors, you live in the wrong place. That's one of the powerful lines from one of Margarita Ingles' poems featured in her new book, Jazz Owls. The novel tells the story of the Zoot Suit Riots, or as Engel calls them, the Sailor Riots. Engel's poetry weaves the story of a Mexican-American family in Los Angeles, California, living under the shadow of the Second World War. We have Margarita Engel joining us to talk about her book and about the importance of this story today in 2018. Engel is also the first Latino Young People's Poet Laureate. Thank you for joining us, Margarita.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So give us a sense of the historical context in which your novel takes place. What was happening at the time and what exactly the Zoot Suit Riots were?
Well, the first thing that happened is millions of sailors were receiving their basic training in Los Angeles, which is my hometown. Hundreds of musicians also poured into Los Angeles. Wherever the sailors went, there was music and dancing, and the USO encouraged local girls to come out and dance with the sailors. It was good for morale for them to get out and have fun on their way to these horrible battlefields. But the sailors were coming from all over the country, including the South, and many of them were enraged at the sight of interracial dancing. They just could not handle seeing the young Mexican-American youth dancing together with white kids and black kids and Chinese. And the sailors attacked the young Mexican-American boys who were wearing zoot suits, which were loose, cool clothing that was perfect for this type of dancing. And they stripped the Mexican-American teenagers of their zoot suits and burned the clothes. They pulled kids off of streetcars. They pulled them out of movie theaters and coffee shops, restaurants, and the sailors rioted. But the police would not arrest men in uniform, so they arrested the teenagers.
Your novel is centered around a Mexican-American family that is having a firsthand experience with these riots. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the main characters?
Yes, I really wanted to look at the lives of women at the time. Even though the sailors were attacking boys, primarily teenage boys, these girls were being encouraged by their government, by the U.S. government, to go out and dance with the sailors. And so again, for me, there's this tremendous contrast between being expected to be patriotic, to dance, and to donate blood, and to have a victory garden, all of these things while the sailors are attacking your brothers. I wanted to look at the ways in which the attitudes of girls and women and also the opportunities for them changed very quickly during these war years. They were working in the canneries at first, but as the war went on, they moved into the aircraft industry and making parachutes and all sorts of jobs that would have been filled by men before the war.
Now, we've alluded to this a little bit, but I'd love it if you could give us a clear sense of the parallels that are in your book and also what you're seeing, what we as a country are seeing playing out today in 2018, particularly with Latino, either undocumented or even in some cases not undocumented Americans.
Well, I think it's really history repeating itself in terms of the U.S. government choosing scapegoats to stir up fear. The reporters, you know, saw an opportunity to sell newspapers, and so they would speculate and exaggerate and tell the story in a way that it would create fear, because fear sells when it comes to newspapers, and today it would be the, you know, 24-hour news cycle. So this thing of choosing Latinos as scapegoats happens repeatedly, and again, contrasts very dramatically with the official image of the country as a champion of freedom.
I wanted to ask you, was that what actually led you to want to write this book? Was seeing these types of changes something that compelled you to write it, or were there other reasons behind that?
Well, I had already started. I had been researching it for a long time. I was aware as I grew up of the history of the Zoot Suit riots, so I really kind of wanted to zero in on the emotional essence of the story. What did it feel like? And I hope that a young reader, a teenager, or a sixth grader even might read this story and imagine, you know, what it felt like and become interested in history and how history repeats itself, so that we can, you know, if we learn about it, we can prevent that from happening, but also become interested in poetry. I think poetry is very personal and very emotional. It's a safe place for a young person's emotions, and they need that safe place for their emotions. And I would hope that reading poetry might inspire them to write some of their own, too.
And you were actually going to share a poem, which is an excerpt from this book. Before you read that poem, I'm wondering if you can tell us who's the central character and what they're dealing with.
Well, there are two sisters in the family, and this one is Lorena, and she's working in the canneries, and she's become a union organizer. And at this point, she's talking about the ways things are changing, and the poem is titled, "What Will the Future Be Like?" It's in the voice of Lorena. While peach season leads to tomatoes, Marisela is gradually transformed from one person into another without losing her original self. I'm changing too. My hair bobbed short, my clothes so deliberately dull that no one would dream of wearing them to a dance. I spend part of my paycheck on union dues for dignity and part on war bonds to help Papa and Nico fight for liberty from the Nazis' hateful ways. But who will struggle for freedom from racial hatred here at home?
Margarita Engel is the first Latino Young People Poets Laureate. Her book, Jazz Owls, a novel of the Zoot Suit Riots, is on sale now. Margarita, thank you for sharing that with us.
Thank you.
Let's hope for an enthralling contest between these two footballing teams, one representing Africa, the other representing CONMEBOL and South America.
Possibly both of these teams will be the end of their World Cup.
It was do or die for both Nigeria and Argentina in Tuesday's Men's World Cup match, with a place in the round of 16 on the line. Nigeria, the underdog, was up against the mighty Argentina, led by their star, Lionel Messi. At Buka, a Nigerian bar and restaurant in Brooklyn, fans gathered to support the team known as the Super Eagles. Big names were there, including the actresses Uzo Aduba and Adepero Oduye. They were among the many people in attendance, including tons of Nigerian fans, young professionals sneaking out from work, and a few families.
We don't have a goal yet, but we are very hopeful. I'm very hopeful.
I think Nigeria needs to step it up and be a lot more aggressive and show that they really want this.
We're going to kick Argentina's behind. And Nigeria will be the first African country to ever win the World Cup.
It takes time for us to build momentum. I think we've built that now, so I expect that in the second half we'll do better and at least get a draw from the game.
Nigerians, we're always fighting tribalism and all that, but once the World Cup starts, it's all love, man. Camaraderie everywhere.
In between the two halves of the match, fans place food orders.
So two akara, one jollof, one beans.
Beans, yeah.
No meat?
No, I'm vegan. That's why. Vegetarian.
I think second half might prove to be the true test of what Nigeria is really made of. Because watching the game right now, I feel like I don't see the zeal and enthusiasm I saw last game.
That's Amayo, who came to the United States in 1978 on a soccer scholarship to Howard University.
My hopes then was really to promote Nigerian culture, and I'm very, very fortunate that I was able to do that, you know. So promoting Nigerian culture through soccer and through sports was my vehicle and my platform to do what I did and where I am today.
Today, Amayo is the lead singer and percussionist for the band Antibalas, and for him, Nigeria's success on the field is about having a place on the world stage.
Soccer, you know, football is one of the greatest unifiers in the world. And whenever a team participates, you know, in the World Cup, it not only, you know, sheds, you know, light to that country's culture, it also helps people from that particular country, you know, be able to, you know, expound their pride, you know, and then really, really show how, you know, how proud they are of being from that country.
It was Nigeria's sixth time qualifying for the World Cup. The last time was in 1994. They're ranked 47th by FIFA, and Argentina is ranked 5th. Amayo anxiously awaited for the Super Eagles to step up their game.
I haven't really seen, like, something really exciting from each of the players that can make me want to, like, follow that player and see how, you know, how awesome they truly are. So I'm still waiting to, you know, to see the true player out of the Nigerian team. I haven't seen it yet, you know, personally.
And in the second half, things did pick up. Nigeria's Ahmed Musa evened the score with Argentina.
I'm trying to reserve my excitement. It's still 1-1. So I have hope.
But it wasn't enough.
Mercado, that's a good cross. Brilliantly finished. A different noise around St. Petersburg now. Argentina are back in the position of strength.
The Argentinians scored another goal just 5 minutes before the game ended. Other disappointed fans who stuck through the end held out some hope.
Super Eagles for life still, you know. We'll get them in 2022.
As one spectator said, well, there's always Senegal.
you know, on to root for Senegal, the last, you know, sub-Saharan African country left. So hopefully there's still hope for one African country to get to the next round.
Senegal faces a tough challenge against Colombia on Thursday. And it seems like a lot of you have World Cup fever.
This is Pat Busher in Portland, Oregon.
My name is Michelle, and I'm from Somers, New York.
Jenna from Somerville, New Jersey.
My name is Joshua. I'm from Lehi, Utah.
And I'm calling from Haiku, Hawaii, Maui.
We don't have a dog in this fight, so it makes it real easy to just watch the game and enjoy the beauty of the play.
I was rooting for Iceland, but I'll root for the only North American team, Mexico.
I am now totally rooting for Argentina. I really want to see Messi get the World Cup trophy that I feel he deserves.
I will be cheering for Spain.
I've been rooting for Iceland since it's their first year competing, but I have been really impressed with how well England has been doing.
I am rooting for Brazil because my parents are immigrants from Brazil. So, yeah, go Brazil.
I just want an American team to win, get out of Europe, but Croatia is blowing my mind.
And who are you rooting for? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tell us on the Takeaways Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.